When you hear the word liberalism, what do you usually think? I mean, everyone has a definition for this word. It's come to mean a great many things, hasn't it? To some, it's a sweet sound. To some, it's derogatory. It has an old meaning, a new meaning. We're going to talk about the meaning of that word. And hopefully, after this first half hour of Issues Etc., we're going to be spending it with Dr. James Hitchcock of St. Louis University. You will have a better idea of what this word means, and we're going to couple it with the definition of that word, modernism. The two actually have become somewhat interchangeable in our conversation, and we're going to play that out in the course of this first 25 minutes of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Feel free to join us for the next 3 hours. We've got a lot of stuff to do. My goodness, it's going to be a very interesting day. After we finish our conversation with Dr. James Hitchcock, we'll be talking with Steve Bright of the Christian Research Journal about two issues briefly to round out this hour. We'll talk about a Christian-Muslim peace program that's being launched by the Fuller Theological Seminary. Now, Fuller Theological Seminary isn't just any old seminary. It is the home, the headquarters, if you will, of the church growth movement. It's been the place that if you want credentials in the church growth movement or as a church growth pastor or theologian, you go there. You get your degree there. Regardless of where you got your other degrees, you go to Fuller. Now, Fuller has launched a peace program. Part of the program is an agreement between Muslims and Christians not to proselytize. We've talked about it a little bit. We'll find out more about it with Steve Bright. We'll also talk with him about a recent scam of congregations and televangelists, a Ponzi scheme that even took in the likes of Benny Hinn and Marilyn Hickey. We'll talk about that to round off this first hour of Issues Etc. today. Then, in the second hour of the program, prayer. Today, if my calendar is correct, is the National Day of Prayer. Christians gathering around flagpoles and city streets and churches for special services. We'll talk about what prayer really is with Pastor William Turgeson of the Lutheran Church of Our Redeemer in Peekskill, New York. That's in the second hour of Issues, etc. A little bit open lines there to round off that second hour. And then we'll be talking with Father Richard John Newhouse. We're going to be speaking of First Things magazine, of course. We're going to be speaking with him in answer to this question. Should presidential candidate John Kerry receive Holy Communion as a Roman Catholic? For that matter, should Roman Catholic politicians who deviate from their church's clear teaching on the life issue receive Holy Communion? How big of an issue is the life issue in Roman Catholic teaching? All of those questions answered by Father Richard John Newhouse in the third hour of Issues Etc. Then, Dr. Stephen Rhodes, author of the new book, Taking Sex Differences Seriously, will join us to round off the program altogether there in the third hour. We'll be talking about the differences between the sexes. The term gender is often used. Of course, gender means just about anything. Sexes. It's a little more explicit. Men and women. There are only two of them. We'll talk about the differences in the third hour of Issues Etc. today. Dr. James Hitchcock is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. He's a professor of history at St. Louis University, author of a forthcoming book, The Supreme Court and Religion in America. Dr. Hitchcock has also written the cover story, and it's an excellent one. I recommend that you read it, folks. In the latest issue of Touchstone Magazine, titled Supremely Modern Liberals. Dr. Hitchcock, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much.
You say in the middle of your article, the worst condemnation that a liberal can hurl at someone who is religious is, you claim to have the truth. What does this tell us about what liberalism has become today?
Well, of course, it tells us that it has become completely relativistic. That is to say, there is no truth. Everything is only relative to your culture. That wouldn't have necessarily been true of liberalism years ago. And even today, I'm sure that people who vote Democratic don't necessarily feel that way. But if we take the issue, just for example, right now of gay marriage or the issue of abortion or any number of other things like that, the answer keeps coming back, well, you claim to have the truth. You seem to know the truth. And the obligation then is you must agree with us that there is no such thing as any final truth here. And it even spills over a bit into politics, because if you take people's attitudes towards, say, terrorism, a certain type of liberal who will say, well, you know, why were those people attacking us on September the 11th? It's not all right and wrong. You know, we might have done some things which offend at them. There's always going to be a moving away from anything that could be a final principle of right and wrong.
So liberalism wasn't always what it is today. You write also about the term modernism, and you come to the point pretty quickly in your article that these two have become interchangeable. And for what reason? Why is it that modernism, what was it, what is it, and how has it become synonymous with liberalism today?
Well, modernism is a bit complicated. I started at the French Revolution, where in order to free yourself or to make progress, you simply have to destroy everything. Then it carries over into the arts, and the new idea that starts with the arts in the 19th century, that creativity necessarily has to do with rejecting the past and doing something that will shock people's sensibilities, that will be unfamiliar. It becomes for some people a way of life, which was originally called bohemians, and they were called, they ended up being called hippies. I'm trying to remember, what did we call them in the 50s? We had another name for them, the Beats, I guess.
Beatniks, yes.
Yeah. And I don't think that was necessarily part of liberalism as a political movement until the 60s. I think it starts, in some respects, with the confrontation at the Democratic Party in Chicago in 1968, and then the candidacy of Senator McGovern in 72, in which this all now comes together, which it hadn't been before. I think the reasons for that are somewhat complicated, but in the simplest terms, I would say the ideas of modernism had been around for a while, and now they finally filtered down. And you had a sort of a prosperous, especially younger people, had a fair amount of money. They had been raised in what I would call often a pampered way. They wanted everything for themselves. They didn't want to put any restrictions on themselves. So the gospel of modernism, which was reject everything for the sake of freedom, becomes pretty much synonymous with liberalism.
I read recently, and I mentioned it several times on the air to our listeners, a columnist writing in a completely unrelated vein gave a definition of liberalism that I thought was just brilliant. Liberalism, as opposed to conservatism, has a presumption against tradition. Conservatism has a presumption in favor of tradition. Now, tradition may be proved guilty, but it's innocent until proven guilty, according to a conservative viewpoint. A liberal simply assumes it to be guilty until proven innocent. Is that a good definition there?
I think so. I would say, especially, again, it wouldn't have been true maybe 40, 50 years ago, but it is true now. Again, we could take the gay marriage thing, which is, you know, a good hook right now. It is amazing, it seems to me, that thousands of years in which human beings have regarded marriage as the relationship between a man and a woman could be discarded in what you might say casually, literally in a matter of a few months, or by the stroke of a pen. And people who just sort of shrug their shoulders and say, well, you know, what's the problem? That's exactly it. You know, every established belief in the eyes of the liberals is automatically suspect. In a way, the fact that it's been around for thousands of years in and of itself makes it suspect. It's an old prejudice.
Is the liberal effort to deal with the word marriage, is it an effort to undermine it or to redefine it, or is there really a distinction?
I think in the end there is no distinction. There's been some studies that have been made of homosexual marriage in Scandinavia, and one of the things that the student found was a lot of homosexuals advocated gay marriage on the grounds that we want to strengthen the institution of marriage by broadening it. The number who then chose to take advantage of this was relatively small, and that some homosexual spokesmen now admit, we're not in favor of marriage, but this was in fact a way of, you know, advancing our agenda. And I think the same is true today. I haven't been hearing much about homosexual marriage until fairly recently, and a good deal of the homosexual literature doesn't talk about marriage, doesn't talk about permanent commitments, doesn't talk about anything that would even remotely resemble monogamy. And I think that the shrewder homosexuals realize that the push for gay marriage will simply have the effect of undermining marriage itself.
So as you point out, in Scandinavian countries where homosexual marriage is legal, very few avail themselves of that legal privilege.
Yeah, relatively few. And, of course, we have a big, highly publicized push right now in which, quite obviously, everybody who's doing this is extremely conscious of the publicity value involved. Once it settles down, and if it becomes an established thing in places like Vermont, I wonder if we're not going to see that it's relatively, nobody's really interested. It's interesting too. I've read accounts by homosexuals who talk about, oh well, I've had this I've had this faithful relationship with my partner now for 26 years, but with surprising frequency, they will admit that that does not mean sexual fidelity. We're still free to go our own ways. What we do on weekends, we don't talk to one another about that. It's not the other guy's business. I think the whole idea of a monogamous relationship is foreign to the nature of homosexuality itself.
In fact, wasn't it one of the brightest lights in the pro-gay marriage movement, Andrew Sullivan, has been kind of called on the carpet for what people conceive of, or at least they perceive, a inconsistency. On the one hand, he says, look, the reason that homosexuals have been forced in the closet is because they haven't been afforded the privilege of marriage. So please let us have it, and we won't have all these dysfunctional attitudes and behaviors. And yet earlier he has written that he doesn't believe that the homosexuals can be monogamous in the sense of heterosexual monogamy.
That's correct. And in fact, even when he's making the plea for gay marriage, he then says, one of the things which straight people have to learn from us is a broader understanding of fidelity. And then he says, the notion of monogamy, faithfulness to one partner, is something that heterosexuals, I don't think he uses the word hang up, but that's what it comes down to, something you're hung up on. And we homosexuals can enlighten you on how fidelity to your partner doesn't necessarily mean not having sex with other people. I mean, he says that explicitly.
You have written this, liberalism, or modernism for that matter, but we use the term liberalism to now count for both since they're synonymous, transforms every political disagreement into a dispute over fundamental beliefs. What do you mean by that? Give us an example that we'd be familiar with, of liberalism transforming every political disagreement
right
into a dispute over fundamental beliefs.
Well, I mean, again, you know, the so-called social issues are the most obvious ones, in the sense that everybody knows on gay marriage, we're not simply debating whether people should be able to get retirement benefits and medical insurance and all of that. This is an attempt to absolutely change the way society looks at the very nature of the sexual relationship. If you go back to abortion again, it's not just, well, you know, there's a sticky problem here of unmarried mothers and what are we going to do about it, but it's an attempt to revolutionize our notion of who is a person, and revolutionize our notion of motherhood. And even if you go back, say, to the Clinton controversies, this wasn't with his sexual affairs. This wasn't just did he or didn't he do it, or if he did do it, did it interfere with his actions as president of the United States? We were asked to engage in a referendum. You should show yourself to be a good, broad-minded, modern person who says it doesn't really matter what the president does. Maybe we should even admire him a bit. And the real villain is that Kenneth Starr, because, you know, he's such a Puritan. And it does, you know, as I say, every one of these issues, even again, to a certain extent, the terrorism issue, comes down often enough to patriotism. Don't think that your country is right all the time. If your country has got enemies, probably there are good reasons for that. Maybe we're the ones who should be apologizing. Fidelity to one's country is not necessarily a virtue. These things just cut across every kind of an issue.
We're talking about liberalism, modernism, with Dr. James Hitchcock, professor of history at St. Louis University. He's author of the forthcoming book, The Supreme Court and Religion in America. He's also written the cover story for the latest issue of Touchstone magazine titled Supremely Modern Liberals. Dr. Hitchcock, what happens when liberalism, in its kind of current form, driven to deny everything that has come before, it's an impulse it cannot resist. It goes out looking for things to deconstruct and redefine. What happens when it meets the church?
Well, the church then, of course, necessarily must look like the implacable enemy. Now, if by the church you mean what is sometimes now called mainstream Protestantism, those churches have pretty much accommodated themselves to liberalism a long time ago, and they, in fact, are viewed by the liberals as allies, and in fact the liberal agenda has penetrated deeply into those churches. But as it encounters the more conservative churches, they are regarded as enemies, and they stand in the way of progress. I published an article a few months ago in First Things called Enemies of Religious Liberty, and documented there, it'll be in my book, political theorists who actually say parents should not have the right to inculcate into their children these conservative religious principles, because these conservative religious beliefs stand in the way of the kind of country that we want to have. So there is a fierce antagonism to anything remotely resembling Orthodox religion, and I think most religious believers, by and large, are oblivious to this fact. They don't understand the degree to which that antagonism exists.
You have also said that liberalism as a set of beliefs and ideas, a way of behaving in the public square, is a good example of what philosophers call Zeno's paradox. Explain Zeno's paradox to us, if you would, and tell us how it is that liberalism is an example of this.
Well, Zeno's paradox comes from an ancient philosopher who said you can't ever get where you're going because you have to travel half the distance between where you are and where you're going, and each time you travel half the distance, you have to travel half of that distance, et cetera, et cetera, so you'll never get there. Well, there's a fallacy to that. I don't know what it is, but anyway, liberalism is sort of in the business of systematically denying every certitude, but on the other hand, if they deny all certitudes, where will they be? There will be no program left. There will be nothing to do. So it does always tend to stop a bit short. So, for example, leading Democrats like Senator Kerry will not actually endorse a homosexual marriage, at least not this time around, maybe the next time around. But the other thing is they do, in a certain sense, invent new absolutes, but it's not at all obvious how they do that. For example, feminism is an absolute. Environmentalism is an absolute. Well, by their own principles, they can't prove why those should be that way, because there's no such thing as an absolute truth. But in what's called postmodernism, you simply, if you can grab the reins of power, you impose your agenda. And the postmodernists will claim everybody does that anyway. So liberalism then, in a way, is always changing the subject. You know, suddenly global warming, which we never heard of maybe 10 years ago, becomes a central issue, and they push it, fanatically. And then after a year or two, it'll be something else.
Is this something of an... you talk about a maniacal urge... you put it in other terms as well. Is this an addiction? Once you say everything that has come before must of necessity be overturned, a revolutionary spirit, I guess you could call it, do you eventually get addicted to doing this? You can't stop?
I think in a way that's true. It's a negative absolute. I mean, I think there are people who probably can live comfortably with believing in very little, you know, and saying, well, you know, I don't know what's true, what's false, but I'm living a comfortable life. That's all I care about. But there are people who, in a certain sense, even if they're denying that there's any such thing as truth, somehow have to have something to believe in. So the negation of truth itself becomes the truth. And I think it is. I think the word addicted, which you mentioned there, is a very good one. Others, I think, are just kind of intellectually trapped. You can grow up in our culture and have what looks like an excellent education, but depending on what schools you went to and what teachers you had and what books you read, you would actually see no way out of this. No one would have ever taught you anything that would explain to you how this corrosive skepticism is wrong and how you can, in fact, find some basis for truth. they just simply literally don't know how. To them, it's just self-evidently correct, and they can't see any alternative.
You have written that abortion, beyond all of the other issues that liberalism has taken up, is the issue at the highest levels of liberalism where there can be no compromise. Why is abortion as an issue so well suited to these tendencies of liberalism and modernism?
Because I think, in a sense, it is really the most horrifying. You know, everybody cringes at the thought that a mother is killing the child in her womb, and everybody cringes at what is quite obviously a perversion of the relationship between mother and child. Mother is supposed to be protective of the child. Here the mother is causing the child's death. So it is the one that is, in one sense, hardest to justify. And for that reason, it has to be justified, because it is the hardest. And when we come up with partial birth abortion, where most people, when they find out what it is, are horrified once more and say, no, 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 you can't do that. You can't crush the skull, etc. They have to push it all the harder. Because if they give in on that, then they have to sort of admit that they've been wrong. And I don't think they can turn back.
Is there any point at which a thoroughgoing liberal will say, okay, this is where I finally wanted to get to. I've pushed far enough, or maybe I've pushed a little too far, and I need to back up a bit?
There are some liberals who say that, but then they are immediately called conservatives. you can, if you go back a long way, you can find various points along the spectrum where you can say, yeah, it looks like here they arrived at where they wanted to be. But those points turn out always to be temporary. Now, an absolute, apparent absolute, which is very much on our minds right now, is the sexual molesting of children, where almost everybody agrees that's wrong. Almost everybody. If you look just a little bit beneath the surface, you find people who are, in fact, rationalizing it or justifying it. And I predict that sometime in the next 10 years, there are going to be liberals who are going to say, we need to take a second look at this. You know, we were stampeded into a certain amount of hysteria over this question. And this might be actually a very liberating experience for the child. There are people saying it now. They're marginal people. But that is a very good example, I think, of how the liberal line drawing, but the line never remains stable.
Dr. James Hitchcock, I hope your prediction does not come true in that respect, but I do respect your opinion on all of these things. I just hope you're not a prophet in that respect.
I hope so, too.
Thank you for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Thank you.
Dr. James Hitchcock, he's professor of history at St. Louis University. He's author of a forthcoming book titled The Supreme Court and Religion in America. He's written the cover story for the latest issue of Touchstone Magazine titled Supremely Modern Liberals. Now, here's the website for Touchstone Magazine, www.touchstonemag.com. It's all one word, touchstonemag.com. You can also subscribe to Touchstone by calling the Fellowship of St. James toll-free at 1-877-375-7373. That's 1-877-375-7373. Ask for Touchstone Magazine. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do Christians, Jews, and Muslims worship the same God? Can someone worship God the Father apart from Jesus Christ? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. I've written an article for the next edition of the Issues, Etc. journal. It's called Mere Monotheism, and you can receive a complimentary copy of the Issues, Etc. journal by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. What's the difference between a knowledge of God and the true worship of God? Find out with the Issues, Etc. journal, 1-800-737-0172. The next issue also details Dr. Leonard Peyton's journey from Calvinism to Lutheranism, 1-800-737-0172. Now, if you enjoy Issues, Etc., the radio show, you need to get the Issues, Etc. journal. Call now, 1-800-737-0172, and ask for a free copy of the Issues, Etc. journal.
Prayer. This Global Minute lets you hear that missionaries get guidance through regular prayer. In North Africa, an outreach team was praying that they would meet someone who was ready to hear about Christ. The team was formed through the mission agency Operation Mobilization. Soon, a man named Hamid tapped one of them on the shoulder and introduced himself. He spoke English well and was curious about the group, so he invited them to a coffee shop so he could ask them questions. The group gave Hamid cassette tapes from the Gospel of Luke, and two of the team members visited him the next day. They sat with Hamid, taking him through verse after verse of scriptures, and he prayed to receive Christ. Pray that more people in North Africa will want to ask questions about Christ. Learn how to use your skills in missions. Visit the website www.usa.om.org. That's usa.om.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. 50, 45, 40, 30, 20, 10. Abraham prayed for Sodom. Sodom, synonymous with the most sinful conducts. And the Lord answered for the sake of 50, 45, 40, 30, 20, 10 righteous people, I will not destroy it. Genesis 18. Jesus says he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and unrighteous. God has a heart for all people, wants all to be saved, even those who refuse to walk in his ways. 50, 45, 40, 30, 20, 10, God has more of a heart for contemporary culture than some hard-hearted religionists do. And that's not to say that all roads lead to God, that it makes no difference what you believe. God looks at culture with a special smile, a gleam in his eye, for those who walk in his ways, even if they are a minority. 50, 45, 40, 30, 20, 10, not esteemed by society, the faithful are most precious to God. When judgment comes, as it must, he will save his people. Today is the National Day of Prayer. 50, 45, 40, 30, 20, 10. Is there much difference between then and now?
It's a long-standing tradition at AM 850 KFUO. Every Sunday morning we carry two live worship broadcasts from area churches. At 8 o'clock we carry the service from Beautiful Savior Lutheran Church in Bridgeton. The Reverend Thomas Eckstein is the pastor. Then at 11 o'clock we broadcast our second service, this time from Ascension Lutheran Church in St. Louis, where the Reverend Charles Spomer is the senior pastor. If it serves you well, listen to one or both of our Sunday morning worship broadcasts on AM 850 KFUO, Inspirational Christian Radio for the World.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. Let's see. In the latter part of this hour, we're going to be talking about two issues. First of all, there's a Christian-Muslim peace program that's being launched by Fuller Theological Seminary. Now, Fuller Theological Seminary is not just any seminary. Our guest, Steve Bright, assistant editor of the Christian Research Journal, is going to join us not only to tell us what Fuller is, what role it plays in kind of general American evangelicalism, but also about this Christian-Muslim peace program and why it may be problematic for some. And we'll also be talking about a recent scam that took in Christian congregations and several televangelists, among them Benny Hinn and Marilyn Hickey. We're not talking about small potatoes here or small change. We'll talk about that during these 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Steve Bright is our guest. He's assistant editor of the Christian Research Journal. Steve, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thanks, Todd.
Steve, let's start with this issue about the Christian-Muslim Peace Program at Fuller. Give us some background on Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, California.
Fuller's probably one of the largest evangelical seminaries in the country, very influential. It has about 4,000 students that come from 60 countries and over 100 evangelical denominations. So its influence is pretty wide-reaching in this country especially and even overseas because they've been very evangelistic and pushing missions programs.
Am I right? Their influence also extends through the fact that a lot of pastors from across denominational lines will go and do supplemental work, graduate work, and they'll choose Fuller to do it at, right?
Yes, and it carries a lot of weight with its graduates. Very well-known, influential pastors across the country have their degrees from Fuller.
All right, tell us about this Christian-Muslim peace program that Fuller is proposing.
This is something that was, it's built on the work of a Fuller professor named Glenn Stassen and some other Christian scholars, and they've developed a peacemaking theory. That's what they're working on there, and the Justice Department basically gave them $1 million to work on this peacemaking theory, or what they call a conflict resolution program.
So how do they plan to, what is this going to look like on the ground? Before we get into some things that are a bit problematic concerning its code of ethics, what's it going to look like as Fuller Theological Seminary envisions this peacemaking program?
Well, it's still not out yet, so the details of it are still sort of unclear. The most I've been able to find out is they're looking to eventually have two national conferences of Christian and Muslim scholars, and they're working together on these peacemaking practices based on the Quran and other sources and the Bible. Eventually, it'll work into a book, what they come up with, but the bulk of it is going to be a two-year project that's going to have a code of ethics that basically, what they say, rejects offensive statements about each other's faiths and affirms a mutual belief in one God and a pledge not to proselytize. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily that no one can share their faith, but they're going to try to turn it into what they call gracious evangelism. And what that means exactly is part of the controversy.
Now, the devil here is obviously in the details because, I mean, how does one define offensive statements about one another's faith? How does one define a mutual belief in one God? And, as you just pointed out, how does one define proselytization?
Right, and even more fundamentally, as I was reading it, it seemed to be based on the idea that it's going to educate the Christian members of Christian denominations, or evangelical Christians, let's say, on as to what Islam is, as if that's where all the tension is coming from. And I think it was the news articles that I read seem to say that it grew out of the statements that were made after 9/11 by well-known evangelical figures that were critical of Islam or Muhammad. So they're assuming that all the tension is coming from Christians not being educated as to what Islam is, and they're trying to address that and rectify that situation.
As far as you can tell, does the Fuller program also seek to educate the Muslim about the true nature of the Christian faith and seek to educate American Muslims as to, you know, perhaps correct some of their misconceptions?
Yes, they're definitely involving the Muslims in the whole process. Sherwood Lingenfelter, he's Fuller's senior vice president, for example, said, this was his quote about it, we hope to lead a large portion of evangelical Christians into a better understanding of Islam. After 9/11, there was a great deal of hostility in the Christian community towards Muslims. It's important to gain a respect for them and treat them with dignity and not assume they're all terrorists. So, yes, it seems to be, we don't know the details, yes, but according to his statement, the education is, the need is on the Christian side to be educated about Islam.
What is the end, what's the end game here?
The education, apparently. It's the Justice Department funded it because it is a peace program. And, for example, they would fund the certain centers, Jewish centers out here in California, to do studies and work with the police on how to deal with hate crimes. And they don't have a problem with a separation of church and state in this particular instance because it's not funding any sort of proselytizing or worship or anything like that. This is actually funding a study on how to promote peace between Christianity and Islam.
Is it a domestic thing, or does this project envision something outside the borders of the U.S.?
Both, inside and outside eventually. It's going to be primarily in the U.S. because that's where the bulk of evangelical Christians are having the trouble with Islam, supposedly.
You mentioned $1 million from the State Department. Is that up? Is that earnest money? Is this something that the State Department plans to fund if it gets up and it gets going and it has legs?
At this point, it's got a 2-year life. There, while the program, I should say, has a 2-year life. Whether they refund anything past that will probably be based on whether they see anything of value coming out of it. And the Justice Department, for example, gives money to. They might give money to a police department to do a particular study on hate crimes, and they fund all sorts of things that make their job easier in dealing with crimes and peace.
Let's talk about some of the critics of what Fuller is proposing to do here. Who are the critics, and what's the source of their chagrin with this proposed Muslim-Christian peace program?
Very simply, they think that they're afraid that it would compromise essential beliefs of Christianity. One of the statements that's been bandied about was that that Christians and Muslims believe in the same God, and conservative Christians such as Albert Mohler, he's the president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, would disagree with that statement, saying that there's an essential difference between God as defined by Muslims and God as defined by Christians.
As far as you can tell, does the Fuller program go on the assumption that Christians and Muslims are worshiping the same God?
Yes.
Is this something you knew at Fuller? I think if you take a broad survey of American evangelicals, they're probably going to answer that question, do Christians and Muslims worship the same God? They're going to say no. But to what degree does Fuller represent American evangelicalism if in its peace program it's saying, yes, they do?
Well, that's really a tough question. If for example, say you have a friend who is 5'10" and he wears glasses and has dark hair and has a limp, and someone comes up to you and says, you know, I met your friend the other day, and he's about 5'5", and he has glasses and blonde hair and a limp, you'd think, well, maybe he's just got a few details wrong. But if he came up to you and said, you know, I met your friend the other day, and he's 6'3", and he's really skinny, and he doesn't have any glasses, and he's a track star, you'd think, well, obviously, he's talking about a different person here. So you sort of are arguing over which of the details are necessary to define this particular person, if that makes any sense. So, you know, Muslims will come along and describe this God this particular way, as in God does not have a son, and Christians will come along and say, yes, God does have a son, and it's Jesus Christ, and they will debate over whether these differences are important enough to say, well, no, you're not actually talking about the same person.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, that's not a detail. That's kind of the point.
Yes, and that's part of the controversy. And each person would draw the line at a different place, and that's where they're arguing over who's drawing the line. And Fuller will probably, even within its own ranks, have people who will draw the line at a different point. They say that the entire Fuller faculty is going to review the code and that they're not going to compromise essential Christian beliefs. Given Fuller's background and some of the other ways, some of the other things that they have compromised in the past, it's going to remain to be seen whether they follow through with that or not.
Or it remains to be seen what they think fundamental Christian beliefs are.
Exactly.
All right. Let's turn to our second issue here, if we could. We're talking with Steve Bright, assistant editor for the Christian Research Journal. The second thing that you have written on recently is a scam that took in not only individual congregations, but some rather prominent, perhaps the most prominent televangelist in many people's eyes, Benny Hinn, Marilyn Hickey, among others. Tell us about the scam.
This was, it's what they call a Ponzi scam, and Gregory Setzer, an international product investment corporation that he ran, would basically approach these pastors and ministries promising to give them very high returns on their investments. And once someone would invest, then they would turn around and get another investment from someone else, pay the previous person some profits out of that second investment, and so on. And there's actually no profit anywhere in the company. There's no products being sold, and the profits are not being taken from those types of sales or anything. And he basically started gained some confidence with the first person, and the second, and that person was introduced introduced him to someone else, and so on. And it was basically a national scam; it wasn't a local scam.
So, what did this individual claim he was doing with investors' money?
He claimed that he had the gift of making profit. He said that he didn't really know how it happened. He just had the ability to buy things cheap and sell them high, basically. And he claimed that he had companies that produced items that sold to larger, well-known retailers such as Costco and those types of companies.
And how did this come to light? I mean, it went all the way to the ranks of really the kind of the higher echelons of televangelists. How did it come to light?
Yeah, we're not talking small. You said before, not small potatoes. It's over $160 million that we're talking about. It involved Assemblies of God groups out here in the West, and it involved $11 million from just one company that represented many different investors. And initially, it started with Ralph Wilkerson. He's a former pastor of Melody Land Christian Center in Anaheim. He had been introduced to Gregory Setzer and invested and made a profit with him. Then he introduced him to Benny Hinn, to Reinhard Bonnke, who is a German evangelist who has rather large crowds over in Africa. And Bonnke introduced him to Benny Hinn, and Benny Hinn introduced him to Marilyn Hickey. And eventually, Marilyn Hickey's son-in-law began to ask questions and wanted to see some of the financial records from International Products Investment Corp. And when none of those were forthcoming, he started investigating and discovered that there were no companies making a profit for this investment company.
So in other words, to put it simply, this may not have been how it actually occurred, but may well have occurred this way. He took Bonnke's money, gave a little bit of, or he took, let's say he took Marilyn Hickey's money, last in line, gave a little to Hen, saying, this is a profit I've made off of your money, Benny. And he took a little of Benny's money and he gave it to Bonnke, saying, here's the profit I made off of your money. But he's actually made no profits. He's just paying some, an endless line of investors so he can continue to pay the latest investor.
Exactly. And the point is to get bigger and bigger investments each time, and he dips into that amount and buys himself a $2.5 million yacht and helicopters and those types of things.
So did they finally discover that that's what he was doing with the money?
Yes. And that's what... When Benny Hinn found out that he was doing that, he had already invested $300,000 and made a 50% profit in 5 months, doubled his money. So he made a second investment, this is Benny Hinn, of $400,000, but he withdrew those funds when he found out that Setzer had purchased all these luxury items.
So what's going to become of Setzer?
The last I heard, in February, they were up for trial, but that was delayed, and the SEC is after him. They have a civil action suit against him. The FBI and the IRS have filed criminal charges against him and several of his family members who are also involved in the company.
Other than the notables, Benny Hinn, Marilyn Hickey, Bonnke, and others, who else has Setzer taken in through this Ponzi scheme?
Well, like I said, I think there was a group of Assemblies of God churches. For the most part, it seems to be that these evangelists themselves were taken in, but not necessarily their congregations. According to the SEC, the Assemblies of God in Northern California and Nevada lost over 3 million. There's a company called Amber Enterprises, which was a pool of investments of a bunch of small investors. They lost over 11 million, so it was national.
Have Bonnke, Hinn, or Hickey made any public statements about their being duped by Setzer?
Yes. The one that I found the most interesting came from Benny Hinn, and he says, "I'm outraged that Gregory Setzer would use the church for his own benefit."
It's a little bit of the pot calling the kettle black there.
There's some irony in that.
Yeah, I guess there is. So what's the the appeal to the greed here? Do you think that the just your opinion, do you think that these televangelists were kind of hoisted on their own petard? I mean, not only being taken in by someone, but someone else who was trying to fleece them.
Oh, absolutely. You know, whether they, whatever their motives were for it, you know, that doesn't exonerate him or add to his guilt either, because he did take, he might have taken people who were sincerely investing as well as people who were in it for just greedy reasons. So
now what I want to know is, okay, you got the Securities and Exchange Commission coming in on this. They're going to be obviously taking care of the wrongdoer here, but there was money taken from one individual and paid out to another by this con artist. What happens to that money? And Bonnke claims to have made almost $1 million on
right.
his investment in this Ponzi scheme.
Right. Eventually, you want to say, okay, well, we're...
Does he get to keep the money?
There has to be some profit. No, they actually, they told the people to set aside any of the profits that they were given because they'll probably end up having to give it back.
So, if I get it right here, then Hickey will have to give her money back to Hinn, and Hinn will have to give his money back to Bonnke, and then whoever was before that has to give their money.
Well, I'm sure that's how the – I'm not a lawyer, but I'm sure the SEC would sort that out and how those profits are returned, just like, you know, when the SEC goes after a when they go after any company who's pulling something crooked. If the people have made a profit off of this, it's the company that's going to have to come up with this money. That's a good question. I don't know. I'm going to have to investigate that and see
I would,
where their money goes.
Look, I mean, even if you don't put it in the Christian Research Journal, I would love to know what happens to this money, because we're talking about millions of dollars here that changed hands. And I'd like to know, I'd like to believe that Benny Hinn just doesn't keep it because it's ill-gotten gains, even though it wasn't by his ill actions.
Right. As far as I've been seen in the news reports, the SEC is telling these people to set this money aside because they may have to give it back.
All right.
But that may not be correct.
Steve Bright, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
You're welcome, Todd. Glad to help you.
Steve Bright is assistant editor of the Christian Research Journal. You can find out more about the Christian Research Journal and even subscribe by calling their toll-free number. It's 1-800-2-JOURNAL, 1-800 the number 2-JOURNAL. All right, we got a few minutes left in this hour, and I'm going to offer a few thoughts here, especially on that last story. Our first inclination, of course, for those of us who watch these televangelists, is to engage in a little what the Germans used to call Schadenfreude, wicked glee. It's a glee at someone else's downfall or misfortune. Wicked glee or shameful glee. Let's not do that. I mean, we do chuckle, and we do see the irony, of course, in Benny Hinn's statements, "I'm outraged that Gregory Setzer would use the church for his own benefit," when Benny Hinn has essentially been doing that with numerous Christians for decades, and Hickey and Bonnke and others. But we should not rejoice when these things happen. We should not. I mean, the reason the Germans called it wicked glee is because it is wicked to rejoice in someone else's, even in Benny Hinn's misfortune or being duped by another con man. Yes, Benny Hinn is a con man. There's no two ways about that. He's a con man of the highest caliber. But that does not mean that we are free to rejoice when he gets taken too. We're going to turn to the subject of prayer. Today is the National Day of Prayer, and many people are praying and talking and preaching and hearing things about prayer. Pastor William Turgidson is our guest, and we're going to take up the last few minutes here in answer to the question, essentially, what is prayer? And then we'll spend some time in the next hour with them as well. Pastor Turgeson, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. It's good to talk to you.
Pastor Turgeson, what is prayer?
Prayer is essentially speaking with God. It is when we bring our petitions to God with our hearts and with our lips, when we offer a praise and thanksgiving to Him, when we tell Him our and our neighbor's need, believing that He hears us and that He will help us.
What do you make of the very oft-used phrase, and I'm sure it's going to be spoken and heard many times today, the power of prayer?
That's a funny kind of a phrase because it could be understood in a positive sense, but it is often understood in a negative sense, in the sense that prayer in and of itself is a power, and that is wrong. Prayer, if it has any power, it has power simply because it is addressed to the true God, the triune God, and it is addressed to Him in faith through Jesus Christ, and therefore it has the promise that God will hear and answer. Prayer in and of itself does not have any power. It's not like, you know, the power of positive thinking or some kind of a spiritual power by which we harness energy and direct it toward a problem or something like that. So the concept of the power of prayer can be understood in a good sense, but usually it's not.
So the power resides in the one to whom we pray, not in the one who prays, or
That's
in the
right.
prayer itself.
That's right.
Pastor William Turgeson is our guest. The subject for the next hour as we begin this conversation, prayer on this National Day of Prayer. He's pastor of the Lutheran Church of Our Redeemer in Peekskill, New York, and he's authored several articles on prayer for his congregation's website. During the course of this conversation, what does Scripture mean when Paul urges the Thessalonians, pray without ceasing? Does that mean hands folded, heads bowed at every moment, or does it mean constantly, at least in one's mind, being engaged in some type of a prayer? I mean, he says it, pray without ceasing. What in the world does it mean? And we'll also talk about how the Christian prays as opposed to, say, how the pagan prays. There's a related question here, and not only how one prays, but what one prays. A recent guest on our program, Pastor John Pless, once said, prayer doesn't begin in us, it begins in the Word of God. We're going to talk about that when we come back. The subject is prayer. Pastor William Turgeson is our guest.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.